If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. My name is Jed Hearn, author of the upcoming fantasy novella, Fires of the Dead. And every episode, it is my job to analyze a story to help you become a better writer. So quickly, before I get into today's episode, which is all about A Canticle for Leibowitz, I want to talk to you about something really awesome that I have coming up. And that is the aforementioned Fires of the Dead. So this is my debut fantasy novella, which is now available on Amazon for pre-order. So the ebook is definitely available there at the moment. The thing comes out on September 20th, but you can pre-order the ebook and it will be automatically delivered to your Kindle on September 20th. And the paperback should be up very soon as well, if not already. So here's the blurb for Fires of the Dead, because you might have heard me talk about it a little bit, but I probably haven't given you the full kind of synopsis. So here it is. Wisp is a pyromancer, a magician who draws energy from fires to make his own flames. He's also a criminal, one job away from retirement, and it can't come bloody soon enough. Leading his misfit crew, Wisp ventures into a charred and barren forest to find a relic that could change the realm forever. But they aren't the only ones on the hunt, and the forest isn't as barren as it seems. A jaded gang leader longing for retirement, a bloodthirsty magician with a lust for power, a brutish fighter who's smarter than he looks, a young thief desperate to prove herself, and a cowardly navigator with secrets that won't stay buried. Together, they must survive fights, fires, and folk tales that prove disturbingly real, if they don't kill each other first. Fires of the Dead is a dark fantasy novella with a unique magic system, perfect for Joe Abercrombie or Brandon Sanderson fans wanting a fast-paced read. So like I said, that's available on Amazon for pre-order. I would really appreciate it if you checked it out. If this show has brought you value, I definitely think you would enjoy Fires of the Dead. So the link for that is in the show notes. And now, for our episode, titled A Canticle for Leibowitz, Exploring Theme Through Structure. So A Canticle for Leibowitz is a 1959 sci-fi dystopian novel by Walter M. Miller Jr. And it's a post-apocalyptic sci-fi book set in this Catholic monastery in the desert of the southwestern United States 600 years into the future, after a devastating nuclear war. And the book kind of follows thousands of years of time span as civilization attempts to rebuild itself from this kind of neo-dark age into a new renaissance, and then, as we'll see later, perhaps into a reversion to the dark age. And if you haven't heard of it before, it's amazingly famous novel. It's won the 1961 Hugo Award for the best sci-fi novel. And as you can kind of tell from that synopsis, it explores these themes of religion, cyclical nature of history, and this idea of the church versus state. And if you're familiar with Carl Sagan, who wrote Contact and was a really great scientist, he listed Canticle for Leibowitz as among the stories that, quote, are so tauntingly constructed, so rich in the accommodating details of an unfamiliar society, that they sweep me along before I even have a chance to be critical, end quote. So what's particularly interesting about A Canticle for Leibowitz, for me, is how it uses structure to explore the theme and create emotion. The novel is divided into three parts. Part one is called Fiat Homo, which means let there be man. Part two is called Fiat Lux, which means let there be light. And then the final third part is called Fiat Voluntas Tua, let thy will be done. So, let's have a look through those three parts and analyze how this very unique structure, with these parts that take place 600 years after each other, contributes to the theme. So in Fiat Homo, let there be man, which is part one, we begin in a 26th century society, and this is basically following a time in the 20th century where civilization was destroyed by this global nuclear war, and there was this massive backlash against advanced technology that led to this development of nukes. So during this backlash, there was this big process of, quote, simplification, end quote, where anyone of learning, and especially anyone who could read, was basically just lynched by rampaging mobs who proudly took on the name of simpletons, and illiteracy became almost universal and books were destroyed en masse. So, as a writer, probably my worst nightmare. And the book picks up in the 26th century, and we're following this 17-year-old novice monk named Brother Gerard, who's on this vigil in a desert. And while searching for a rock to find a shelter, he finds this inscription, and it leads him to an ancient fallout shelter containing what he believes are religious relics, such as handwritten notes on crumbling memo pads, bearing cryptic texts from the 20th century. So this is a nice bit of dramatic irony in the first moment of dramatic irony that we readers get to witness in this novel, because he doesn't understand what's there, and he thinks that these are these religious relics of supreme value. They're a shopping list. He picks up a shopping list that's been written by this former Jewish engineer called Isaac Edward Leibowitz, who was an electrical engineer who worked for the United States military in the 20th century. And Brother Gerard, who works for the religious order that went on to found itself, to create itself in Leibowitz's image, who has now become this kind of venerated saint, he thinks that these are these sacred notes that have been written by their founder. So he rushes back to kind of the monastery. And this part is basically about their attempt to understand these notes and the ramifications of what it means to discover something that's actually been written by their founder. And we see the first kind of clear bit of dramatic irony here that's sort of foreshadowing the theme, which is this idea that things can take on a significance in the future that we can't predict now. So Leibowitz, when he was writing this, he was just an engineer. He was writing shopping list. But then after 600 years, there's been this kind of religious order that have found themselves with Leibowitz as their patron saint in a way. And now that they've found the shopping list, they kind of praise it, and they draw like illuminated manuscripts around it. And it's quite interesting because it sort of reflects how meaning can ultimately be created in anything, but that doesn't necessarily detract from its value. So part two, Fiat Lux, let there be light. So it's now 600 years later than that. Brother Gerard from the first part has been long dead for 600 years. At the end of the first part, spoilers, I should mention a spoiler warning, Brother Gerard dies while attempting to convey this priceless manuscript that is Leibowitz's shopping list to the main kind of religious center of this world. He unfortunately dies during that process. So it is the year 3174, and the Order of St. Leibowitz is still attempting this goal of preserving the half-understood knowledge from before the nuclear war and the Age of Simplification. So they've kind of, and this was set up in the previous part as well, they were essentially accumulating books and hiding them from the general population and trying to preserve these manuscripts and just basically maintain education. However, things have progressed a little bit in society, as you would hope, after 600 years, and the new Dark Age is ending. And what comes after a Dark Age? If you know anything about history, it's a Renaissance. So, a highly regarded secular scholar called Thon Thadeo comes to the monastery, the abbey, and he's kind of a Galileo-esque character, this polymath scientist who sort of is setting out initially to kind of disprove some aspects of the order, kind of coming in and trying to prove that, like, oh, this isn't as significant as you think it is. But he realizes that the order, rather than being this kind of backwards religious organization, is actually quite inventive, and they've created the first electric light based on reconstructing some based on reconstructing some engineering blueprints that Leibowitz, their founder, created. And he is kind of leaves a bit changed, and he's a bit impressed by what's happening there. And we basically get the sense that society is moving forward. Obviously, there are a lot more things that happen in these parts, but I'm just skimming over them because I want to give you the gist, and I'll bring that to a point later. So part three, Fiat Voluntas Tua, Let Thy Will Be Done, is set in the year 3781, and mankind has progressed more or less up to kind of where we are now in real life in the 21st century, and maybe even a bit beyond, because they have nuclear energy and weapons again, as well as starships and extrasolar colonies, which I definitely don't think we have, or if they do have, people have been hiding them very well. There were two world superpowers, and they've been embroiled in this Cold War for 50 years. So, what's interesting in this part is that we get the sense that there might be another nuclear war, there might be another flame deluge, and the Lebowitz Order's mission is to preserve the memorabilia that is associated with their religion, and they've kind of expanded that to preserving all knowledge. So after one of the characters who leads the order dies in this, the monks and everyone in the monastery basically gets on a spaceship as the nuclear explosions begin, as the war, the Cold War between these two big superpowers finally comes to a head. So it's basically implied here that the Earth is destroyed again, and the monks leave the starship, leave Earth in the starship. And Joshua, who is the last crew member to board this ship, kind of has this nice moment at the end where he's just looking at the nuclear fallout kind of destroy the skyline, taking over, I believe the description is, a third of the heavens. And he knocks the dirt from his sandals, which is a semi-religious reference to Matthew 10:14, quote, "If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, leave that home or town and shake the dust off your feet," end quote. The religious allusions continue with the last line of this penultimate chapter, where he murmurs, quote, "Sic transit mundus," end quote. I'm sure my Latin is butchering that, but basically what it means is, "thus passes the world." And they leave. The monks leave with their spaceship full of the knowledge they've accumulated over the centuries, and it's implied the Earth is kind of destroyed. So, these parts, as I mentioned, are separated by periods of 6 centuries each, and a lot happens in them. I just kind of gave you a semi-brief description of them. It was kind of long, but it's because I really love this novel. And the reason why I wanted you to understand that context is because of the theme. So what is the theme? Well, fortunately, there's been a lot of scholarly articles written about A Canticle for Lebowitz, which is unusual for a lot of books I analyze on here. And I want to refer to one in particular by David Samuelson, which appeared in Science Fiction Studies in 1976. The article is titled "The Lost Canticles of Walter M. Miller, Jr.," and he quotes in this article that, quote, "The cyclical theme of technological progress and regress, ellipsis, the foundation stone on which A Canticle for Lebowitz is built," end quote. So that's given us some ideas. It's not enough for me. If we are to consider John Truby's position in The Anatomy of Story, that theme is not merely subject matter, but a moral argument, we can rework the phrasing to say that the theme of A Canticle for Lebowitz is this. Human progress moves in cycles, alternatively growing, dying, and being reborn. The only means to endure through this process, the only way to step outside it, if you will, is through the preservation of belief in something larger than ourselves. So we see this happening a lot in A Canticle for Lebowitz. The main characters of the first part become venerated saints in the second part. And then there's this kind of little gut punch when you think about the fact that they're gone, and that everyone they knew have been gone for years by the time we get to the second part, which is 600 years later. And in this sense, it's one of the best novels I've read that captures this macroness, this large-scaled immenseness of the universe. It's the book equivalent to knowing that the quote-unquote modern Homo sapiens, that is, people roughly like we are now, first walked the Earth about 50,000 years ago. And since then, more than 108 billion members of our species have ever been born, according to estimates by the Population Reference Bureau. We've only got about 7.5 billion of those people alive today, which means that of us currently alive, we humans only represent about 7% of the total number of humans who have ever lived. And if when you put that into perspective, that's quite staggering to think about that. I mean, it's kind of obvious that more people have died than are alive today, but it's still staggering to think about the percentages, and those will only get smaller. And this is the first big point I want to present about the novel. How can you present these ostensibly obvious facts through a new conceptual framework that increases their impact? So Tanaka Fulobowitz is probably the most, like, it has the most impactful deaths in fiction that I've experienced. Not because they're a twist or not because they're a shock or whatever, but because it just makes you realize that, like, ultimately, a lot of the characters are just going to be forgotten, and a lot of their stories are just going to vanish over time, like the sands of a desert. So, thinking about this idea of presenting obvious facts through a new conceptual framework, another example that just cropped up in my mind then and I want to share with you now is there's an ad on Australian television at the moment where they're basically saying you shouldn't look at your phone when you're in the car because the car travels 33 meters while you look down at your phone for 2 seconds or whatever. Now, great, that's given us some stats, it's scary, but it's not as effective as the ad that they've just put out, which is that when you look down at your phone, your car travels through the equivalent of 33 prams before you look up again. 33 prams. So when you say that, it's a lot more impactful than 33 meters. So another takeaway here is what long-lasting cultural impact will your characters have on the story world? Especially in epic-scaled stories, epic fantasy stories in particular, where characters make a big change to the external world. What happens next? How do they consider their own legacy? Are they kind of frightened by what their legacy is creating, like Paul Atreides in Dune, who is terrified of the visions he sees of himself as a kind of emperor in the future responsible for the deaths and genocides of billions of people? Or are they happy for the legacy they're heading towards? Do they realize that the only way for them to make the impact is to sacrifice something in their own life, whether that's their physical life or maybe something smaller like their health or their relationships? What long-lasting cultural impact will your character have on the story world? It's worthwhile considering, especially if you're doing a very large-scaled story. So, again, coming back to that theme that human progress moves in cycles, this is reinforced on a more, I suppose, symbolic level. When you look at the abbot of the first part, so the guy who leads the monastery, in the first part of the story, the abbot is called Abbot Arkos, so two A's, and then the abbot who is the final one who runs the monastery, who dies in the last part, is called Zerki, so starting with a Z. So we've got a transition from the first letter to the of the Latin alphabet to the last letter of the Latin alphabet, A to Z. And this just reinforces that theme of human progress moving in cycles, alternatively growing, dying, and being reborn. And the only means to escape this process, is to kind of step outside it and to preserve something or work towards something which is larger than yourself. So my point here with bringing up that kind of what on the surface might seem very minor, the fact that the abbot's name goes from A to Z, that's kind of the point, because if you're just using big picture things to reinforce your theme, you might run the risk of hammering readers over the head with it. But if you can just reinforce it from a lot of different angles, it's really effective. So it's kind of like, to use a marketing analogy, that whole 7 points of contact idea, where marketing people say that you need 7 points of contact with someone before they will make a sale. So that might mean that they see your billboard, then they get an ad on their Facebook feed, then they get an email, then someone in person gives them word of mouth, and so on and so forth. And by having these 7 points of contact, it kind of allows them to see the message and potentially buy the product. So what are the main takeaways from Mechanical Fulobowitz? Because I acknowledge that this episode has probably been kind of all over the place. And the reason for that is because I wanted to throw as much stuff at you as possible, kind of give you the fire hose, if you will, and then draw it back in at the end to take out some tangible lessons and takeaways from this that only really make sense once you've drank that fire hose, to put that in an analogy. So, number one, the first takeaway from Mechanical from Fulobowitz in terms of using structure to reflect the theme and create emotion. Number one, how can you present ostensibly obvious facts through a new conceptual framework that increases their impact? So, this kind of comes to the idea that there are no new stories, just new ways of telling them. And this should be pretty applicable for a lot of you, because chances are, if there's someone who dies in your novel, well, there have been other people who have died in other novels. How will you present the grief of death, this obvious fact, if you will, through a new conceptual framework that increases its impact. So maybe that means that instead of just having your characters cry when someone dies, maybe another character is really devastated because it means that they now no longer have someone to play table tennis with. And you can tailor this, obviously, to your novels. I'm not saying that all your characters need to be table tennis fanatics, but my point being is that if you can think about different angles from which to approach the same thing, it will make it feel fresh and new for readers, and that's going to create a good experience. Number two, the second takeaway. Consider, what long-lasting cultural impact will your characters have on their story world? What long-lasting cultural impact will your characters have on the story world? If your character dies, do they become a martyr? Do they become despised? Do they become forgotten? What are their reactions to what they consider their own legacy will be? What are their friends and families and loved ones' reactions to what they think their legacy will be? Especially in stories that are epic fantasy and have characters making a big change to the external world, consider what long-lasting impact your character is having on that world. Number three, how can you use structure to create emotion? Like I mentioned, one of the bits that kind of punched me in the guts a lot with The Canticle for Lebowitz is when you get to the second part and you realize that everyone that you just spent 120 pages caring about in the previous part, they're all dead. They're all dead, and most of them have been forgotten as well. So it makes you kind of wonder the meaning of that, and it really just rams home that, if you will, that brutality and pointlessness of death in some regards. So consider how you can use callbacks to create that kind of emotion. Arc words are another way that you can use structure to create emotion. So this is where you have like kind of a phrase that is repeated multiple times throughout the novel, kind of as a motif, and each time the phrasing is the same, but the fact that they're the same character perhaps is repeating it reflects a bit of their change. And if you want to look at art words, definitely Joe Abercrombie's stuff is amazing. He often utilizes this. So, for example, one of his characters is constantly asking himself, why do I do the thing that I do? And this character is a torturer and he does horrible things. So by constantly having him ask himself this, it kind of reflects his character arc a bit, because he's like, initially, why do I do the thing I do? He's talking about torturing someone. Later in the novel, why do I do the thing I do? He's talking about doing, and even worse, torturing. Why do I do the thing that I do? He's talking about setting someone free. So he's changed, and having this grounding point that is the same allows you to realize that change. It's a marker. And you can also think about mirrors. So this is where you kind of start and end the story in a same place. So for instance, the Harry Potter novels, he gets on the train to Hogwarts at the start of the book, and he gets on the train to leave Hogwarts at the end of the book. And by having that mirroring structure to punctuate the beginning and the end, it really helps to, again, like with arc words, just reinforce how far the characters have come, because by having some things that stay the same, it helps you appreciate what's changed. And then number four, how can you use structure to reinforce the theme? And talking of theme, I'd like to close by presenting an alternative lens to view this novel. Because in this book's case, it can make an argument as a kind of religious theme or a more secular theme here. Because if we go back to that idea that the theme here is that human progress moves in cycles, alternatively growing, dying, and being reborn, the only means to endure through this process, the only way to step outside it, is through the preservation of belief in something larger than ourselves. So, given that this book was written in arguably like a more religious time, and it does take place in a Catholic monastery, you can kind of interpret this as being primarily a religious argument, that belief that you need to have a faith in a higher power in order to step out of this cyclical nature of history. Or, on a more secular level, you can see it as a metaphor for knowledge and wisdom being the means to enable endurance and preservation of society's culture. And this is certainly seen towards the end, right? The order has not just become a place to preserve religious knowledge, but when it leaves on the spaceship, it takes knowledge from all over the culture. And it's useful to consider this in your own novels. Like, perhaps you have a dominant reading, but it's also good to think about what are some alternative ways that it could be interpreted. And just on this point, because I find this very fascinating, I would argue that this is certainly the case with modern society, that through stepping outside of ourselves and preserving knowledge and education and wisdom is how we are able to, triumph over cyclical history and prevent us from making the mistakes of the past. There's this foundation called the Long Now Foundation. A friend told me about them about a year ago. They have created a 10,000-year clock, a clock that I believe, it takes 10,000 years to complete one rotation. And they have also, and the point of that, before I move on to the next bit, is to make us appreciate the fact that we need to be around a long time for this clock to finish. So we should probably, try to not blow up the world like A Canticle for Lebowitz did. Interestingly enough, they also have a small cafe/library in San Francisco. And when I was there recently, I walked in there, and they have a book collection of about 2,000 books, which their members voted as being the books that were essential to restarting civilization. One of them, fittingly enough, was A Canticle for Lebowitz. So, there's our episode. Be kind and don't mess with nuclear weapons. So, there's our episode. I hope you really enjoyed it. And if you've been enjoying The Novel Analyst, if you've been enjoying my other stuff, I would massively appreciate if you could go to Amazon and check out Fires of the Dead. Like I said, this is my very first fantasy novella coming out, so I'm super excited. I really hope that it can be successful. If you would like to check it out and potentially pre-order either the ebook or paperback or potentially in a few weeks the audiobook, you can go to jedhern.com/dead, and the link to that will be in the show notes, and I'll have links there to the Amazon page where you can pre-order the ebook, and they'll just send the ebook to your Kindle on September 20th, or you can pre-order the paperback, and the paperback will also be sent to you on September the 20th. So if you enjoy gritty, dark fantasy, fast-paced stories, and a lot of twists and just action and magic systems, you will really enjoy this novella, and I would massively appreciate it if you consider checking it out. It's free on Kindle Unlimited as well, I believe, so if you are into Kindle Unlimited, you can get this for no cost to you. So once again, thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time.